Welcome to the FemTech Health Podcast. Today, we're joined by April Patterson, a seasoned physical therapist specializing in sexual health. We're going to dive into all things related to pelvic health, specifically focusing on persistent genital arousal disorder, PGAD. You're going to learn about the symptoms, causes, and treatment options for PGAD. All right, let's get started with today's show.
I'm here today with April Patterson. She's the owner of WholeBodyLA.com. She's been a physical therapist for over 20 years. She has a specialization in sexual health, and I'm so glad to have her on the show today. I met April years ago at a continuing education course with Dee Hartman, which was all about sexual health. And the first thing that I noticed about April from the beginning was her compassion and her care over people that had sexual health issues. April has been an athlete all of her life, and she had some of her own struggles that led her into the whole pelvic health arena, and especially into the sexual health component. April, I'm so happy to have you on the show today. And you and I talk for hours in the car, so I know this could go on forever, but I'm excited that you're here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here and see you again. This feels like we're in the car again.
Exactly. So April, share with us a little bit about like your journey. You know, you did ortho and sport work for quite a while. You've been in this work, but then you had your own sort of segue into the pelvic health arena. So share with us about that.
So I think just as an inquisitive person doing detective work like we all do in physical therapy, I'd come across my ortho patients with back pain, hip pain, and I always wondered, is there a pelvic floor component? I didn't know too much about pelvic floor PGA, but it just seemed like we were missing a bigger piece of the puzzle. And it's sort of like we just avoid talking about that area. You know, back then, we didn't learn to ask questions about sexual health. That was like very taboo. So that definitely drew my interest. And then when I started having symptoms that I really couldn't explain, I sought out care for myself. And it took a long time. It really wasn't until my symptoms got so bad and where I was really kind of feeling hopeless, like I don't know what else to do. And I was already working then in the pelvic health space, so I was interested. And then around 2013, I was like, okay, I got to learn everything I can, because I had been to pelvic floor therapy and I tried different therapists, and the techniques that really helped me were things that I wanted to learn. And that aren't always the most traditional. They're probably more common now, but it wasn't just like your traditional pelvic PT. And so I think learning different techniques, really kind of developing my own style with that, and just wanting so badly to be able to provide this type of treatment for my patients who are suffering. I see mainly more complex pelvic pain cases, people with persistent genital arousal disorder, and it's my passion. I love working with this population because you just, you know, I know what it feels like to feel so broken, and you've been gaslit by the medical community. You go to many, many doctors. And I sort of avoided that because I knew. It's like, I know they're going to laugh at me. I'm going to feel ashamed. They're going to tell me, you know, that this isn't possible what I'm feeling. And because I have my patients in my office that are telling me these things, and I didn't want to be, I don't think I could have emotionally gone through that at the time, because I was suffering so much and just sort of like pushing through and trying to figure out, okay, how am I going to manage my family? How am I going to manage my house? How am I going to do all the things when you just can't even feel like a whole sane person yourself? And so I got really lucky, because at the time when my symptoms were at their worst, and I could tell you more about persistent genital arousal disorder, but when my symptoms were at my worst, I was able, I received a flyer at the time through this group we called in Southern California, Pelvic Floor Sexual Medicine. And it's sort of bringing the sexual medicine physicians, the pelvic floor doctors together, and we pick a topic. And the topic that day was neurogenic pelvic pain. And I said, this is me, this is me. Like, because I knew I didn't feel like I had pudendal neuralgia. I had multiple nerve pains going down my leg, into my pelvis. It was very position dependent, which really makes you think of spine and disc and all that. And it was just that flyer. And it was, you know, about like a 2.5 hour drive. And I, at that point, could barely drive for a minute. I was just like, it was intense. And I had my friend drive me, and I'm in the back seat. And then I end up, Irwin Goldstein was hosting this, and I went up to him, and I just had to stand in the back of the room because I couldn't sit. And I tapped him on the shoulder. I told him I'd call him the next day, and that was it. From there on, I was one of the first 10 people to actually have spinal surgery for my pelvic condition. And again, I can go more into that at some point. There's so much information. but that was that start of kind of getting more involved in the sexual health space besides what I was already doing with my patients one-on-one. And I think, you know, and also I was really quite comfortable talking about sexual health. And someone would have a surgery and a knee surgery, a hip surgery, and have difficulty having sex because they couldn't get in positions, or, and they were, we had always had that comfortable therapeutic relationship where I think I was just easy to talk to about these things. And I didn't have this reaction that, oh my gosh, sex. Ooh, no. I was like, oh, well, this is a problem. Like, how are we going to address this? Like, let's try this. Let's try these pillows. And so it's just something that I've always felt is part of healthcare. Sexual health is health. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So will you explain a little bit for our audience just about PGAD, yeah, what it is, the symptoms mm-hmm. of it? And of I just want to share with everybody as well, April was just at ISHWISH, which is the International Society of the Study of Women's Sexual Health. Mm-hmm. She is part of ISHWISH. She's presented at ISHWISH before. She actually co-authored a paper on PGAD. So here we go. Let's just jump right in. I want people to understand that they're not alone and that there's actually help for them.
Okay. So persistent genital arousal disorder is PGAD or PGAD. And the name had changed. There's now a little bit broader name and definition when we worked on the nomenclature with the paper. So it's now PGAD/GPD. And GPD stands for genitopelvic dysesthesia, which really just means an abnormal sensation in your genital pelvic region. And that could be buzzing, tingling, shooting, pain, like heat, prickled. I mean, really any sort of nerve sensation. You may not even call it pain. It may feel like something else to you. And one of those types of sensations you can have is persistent arousal. So we still have the persistent genital arousal component to it because you can have GPD, but not have arousal, right? So it's still called PGAD, but it's PGAD/GPD because there's a lot of stigma associated with having arousal, and this arousal isn't associated with pleasure, right? So it's a sensation. It's really a nerve that is causing this arousal sensation, but it's not associated with feeling sexual. Like, you don't want this. You are distressed by this. It has to be distressful to be considered persistent genital arousal disorder. And why might it be distressful? I mean, you can even just think about, like, you're sitting, hanging out, playing with your kids, you're at work, you're driving in the car, and you're getting this constant arousal sensation that, you know, often isn't relieved by orgasm. So if you were to self-stimulate, masturbate, have an orgasm, it often just makes it worse. So you're just on this threshold. It's throbbing. It hurts. And men can have this too. And, you know, you think about how people feel about, you know, sex in general. Like, this isn't associated with being sexual, but you have this, it's sensation. It's really a big mind-boggling feeling that you're, and it leads to not being able to concentrate, not being able to, you know, just see however you feel it. And you also don't know when it's going to come on. So the anxiety that happens about when is this going to happen? Is this ever going to stop? Because for some people it's intermittent, other people it's continuous. It's not really by orgasm. Or if it is, it's like maybe 10 minutes and it comes back. It can feel very cruel. It can feel very heavy at all times. And there's a high rate of suicidal ideation with this because you just want it to stop. And I had it, but it was very, very light in the beginning. And I didn't know what it was. It really wasn't even out in the literature until 2001. So I was having some of these symptoms before it was even talked about. And at that point, they called it persistent sexual arousal syndrome. And they changed that because it's not a sexual arousal. It's a genital sensation of arousal. And so, yeah, it's awful. It really, some people call it, it's like a monster. It's how, can we deal with this? And I think most people don't have an expertise in this. So if you go to your doctor, they're going to be like, I don't know what you're talking about. Or maybe they'll laugh at you. Maybe they're like, I wish my wife had that. Or I wish, you get all kinds of comments and jokes. Like they're making it something it isn't. And that's really very traumatic. There's a lot of medical trauma that goes along with this. So I hope that explains it. But there are causes. And so the nice, the hopeful part of all this is that we developed a region-based symptom system for diagnosing and just really figuring out what's driving this, what factors might be contributing. And at Ishwish, they teach this region-based therapy, and physicians can go to Ishwish, sex therapists go to Ishwish, PTs can go to Ishwish and really learn how to screen for this and collaborate and point people in the right direction. Because it is cruel to make people go through years and years and being told these things and not having any help or hope. And things get worse the longer they're there. They get worse. The psychosomatic stuff kicks in too. I mean, it doesn't take long for your body to have a more sensitized nervous system as well. Even though that's maybe not your cause, it definitely is going to keep persisting things as well. So Ishwish is an amazing organization.
So April, so share with people what would be the steps? Like, how do they find the right physician? How do they find, people who actually know the right work so that, they can be screened appropriately? And then you just talked about a surgical procedure that you had.
Yeah.
So can you share that as well, if you're okay with that?
Okay. Of course. So you could go to ishwish.org and they have a find a provider tab. I'm happy, if you want to reach out to me, I do offer consults, and I offer consults too for physical therapists. So not even just with the patient, I can help you find a physical therapist who may be trained in some of these techniques that I do, and I'm willing to work with them as well, and just sort of how to approach this. I've actually developed a course and want to, for physical therapists in particular, so that we really understand what our role is and how we can help. And some of our role is actually screening. So region one, for instance, is end organ. And so that could be the clitoris, that could be the vestibule, that could be, we're looking at the vulva and looking, are there dermatological conditions? Because there's many causes that create this clitoral sensation. So that would be region one, end organ. Okay. So we're talking vestibulodynia, and that is diagnosed or screened with a Q-tip test to the vulvar vestibule, which I never learned in PT school. And most physicians don't learn it. Your gynecologist is going to be more focused on the organs, the internal aspect of the vagina, your uterus, your ovaries. They're looking for fibroids and the things that can explain maybe some abdominal pelvic pain, bleeding. They're not examining your vulva. And your vulva is where your clitoris is, and the nerves of the clitoris provide that arousal sensation. And there are areas of the vulva that can be involved, right? So we can scrape for that as PTs. We can look at the mobility. We can look at and do that Q-tip test. And if we see something, or we see that, oh, wow, your Q-tip test is positive in the anterior part of the vestibule, which is beneath the clitoris, kind of halfway down. So the vestibule surrounds the opening of the vagina, right? And so if there's sensitivity there on the through the entire vestibule, that means there could be a hormonal issue that's causing that pain. That can cause PGAD. It's very close to the clitoris. Everything's really close together. That could cause PGAD. And it could be like a nerve proliferation. Like, so excess nerve endings happen there. It could be a peripheral nerve, like your pudendal nerve. And, you know, where is that getting compressed? Where is that getting irritated? That would be moving on to region two into the pelvis. Is it your sacral nerve root, right? Is there something going on musculoskeletally with your pelvis, with your sacrum muscles that, you know, activity? This is kind of where the PT brain really thrives. And we can work on reducing that tension or irritation around the nerve. Or is it coming from even higher up, right? And so now we're talking more centrally, and that would be more like your lumbosacral spine, which is where my issue was. Back to region one real quick, because I'm just going to go backwards again, is that with vestibule, so the way the algorithm works is we want to be as clear as possible, right? So with the vestibule, you could get this BLT cream. Your provider will put that. It's called the vestibular anesthesia test. So they put that on the vestibule and then do an after. So you touch them with the Q-tip. Those are my symptoms, right? You've now pointed to an area that is reproducing your symptoms of genital pelvic pain or PGAD. Okay. So now we want to see, is it coming from there? So they numb that area with this cream. It's a very strong anesthetic. It's not just like your lidocaine that you put on that really doesn't do anything. And they retest. And if it's gone, that's a positive test. That's a really, that is going to make you think, oh, we're isolated here. This is where I need to look. Because being able to put your finger on the pain and make it go away is so validating. It's like, oh my gosh, this is it. Like, this is what my life could be like, right? And so, but let's say it still persists. It's not from region one. We move up. We move up to two. We move up to three. So with the lumbosacral spine, you know, back in the day, I'm sure, and you know, really not that long, and people are still saying these things, is that Tarlov's cysts are incidental findings. Well, Tarlov's cysts are cysts within the dura of your, you know, of the, it's spinal cord tissue. It's before it, they're on the nerve root. They're above the nerve root. And if there's cysts there, that could give you symptoms, you know, S2, S3, S4, that is going to give you genital pelvic symptoms. If you're, and maybe not with everyone, just like a disc injury, right? A disc injury doesn't always give people much sciatica. You can look at an MRI of many, many people, and they have no symptoms of sciatica and they have disc injuries. And we don't quite know why some are symptomatic and some aren't. But if you're having these symptoms and you have a Tarlov cyst, that needs to be evaluated. And if someone says, oh, that's not possible, they're wrong. It's very possible. And they're doing operations on them and their symptoms are better. So again, if we want to do something less invasive to confirm before an operation, which the physicians I work with, they want to be successful, right? Like, you don't want to just operate on someone, then it's not going to work. So they really want to see that there's a high chance that this will help the person. And they do diagnostic injection with a very strong anesthetic and a steroid. And they'll do that more like a caudal block by the sacrum if you have a Tarlov cyst. And I mean, there's people that, let's say, that didn't help them, then they're going to look further up. And it could be a tiny annular tear that, like I said, many people have. I had an annular tear at L4-5 of my disc and a disc protrusion. But again, common finding, when they gave me my diagnostic injection, gone. It was like, the steroid for me didn't kick in for a couple of days. And when it did, I could have sex without pain. I could walk without pain. And it wasn't just like I could sit without pain, because that was the thing. The minute I wound up my nervous system and sitting, it was that was it. But I had pain of some sort in my lower extremity, lack of sensation, pain shooting into my vagina. It felt like, oh, piriformis syndrome, like all the things you've been taught, sort of like, it's like piriformis syndrome wouldn't go to inside my vagina. Like this isn't just pelvic floor. It was on half of my body. It was like I had two different sides of my body. Almost like I had to, it's really strange what that does to you mentally and just even how you view yourself and walking and how you move. I felt like I was just cracked halfway down my body. And, you know, I think of like Phantom of the Opera. It was like one side of one side. And I needed them to connect. And it was like one wasn't talking to each other. And one was just always pulsing at me, buzzing at me. And it was sharp. Like it hurt. Like there, I started to avoid things. I started to avoid so many things because the pain was too much. Right. And I was pregnant with this too. Like it was awful. Okay. So region three. Now we're moving on to four and five. Okay. So four is the spinal cord. There hasn't been many cases on that, but it's definitely something for like further research. And then five is the brain. And so there are medications. I'm not sure of them all, but seizure activity sometimes causes this. I know I've been in Dr. Goldstein's office when there are, you know, even like a 9-year-old coming in with PGAD. Like this can happen at any age. This is not sexual. Okay. You know, and she was having seizures and they figured out it was her seizure meds and they needed to kind of switch her medication. So there are medications that sometimes wean off of SSRIs too fast, but they also can help in certain situations. So it's a little confusing. So, you know, you might be on certain mental health psychiatric medication that actually could be bringing this on, or that's something else that, you know, your psychiatrist might not know about this, about the effect of the medication. So I would study the that section of the article. It's all broken down into the five regions, they call it. It's region-based therapy. And look at those medications and just have that discussion. And, you know, Dr. Goldstein does do 10-minute free phone calls. So you can always call his office, get a phone call, just get, you know, that, you know, beginning stages. And there may be providers in your area, or, you know, you might have to drive, fly. It really depends. But people that attend Ishwish should have some knowledge of this. So they're not going to be like, that's not possible. Right? So that can be really helpful.
So, you know, you talked a little bit about some mental health overflow, but but something like this can actually have people sort of have depression or anxiety associated with
100%
it over a period of time. And so many people, if they haven't been seen by their correct provider to actually diagnose them through these regions, actually are being put on antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications, et cetera, thinking, oh, that's the resolution. Or that's going to resolve, because, you know, if you look at a lot of data and research, that's kind of what looks like, you know, oh, well, we're just going to put them on, you know, clozapam, or we're going to put them on something, you know, to sort of downregulate your system. Right. And I love it that you're talking this as like a region-based, you know, medical profile, because then people can actually walk through the profile to be like, hey, okay, I have something in region three. So if you will, for me, just for a second, will you just go through the five regions again and just, you know, just the overview, and that way it kind of cements it in people's minds, whether they're PTs listening or MDs or whoever, that they can kind of have the vision that these are the things that need to be looked through before we just give people, you know, anti-anxiety or antidepressants.
Yeah. And thank you. I mean, there are certain meds that can help dial the symptoms down, but that's not looking for the cause. Like that's not the cause of things, right? So yes, region one. Region one is the end organ. So that's going to be anything in the vulva or in the penis. That is the where the nerves end up. So you could have lichen sclerosis that is causing phimosis at your clitoral hood glands. That's another example. you may not have lichens, but you just may have going through perimenopause and your clitoris shrinks or your vulva becomes sensitized, and that can be giving you clitoral symptoms. And this algorithm of region-based therapy, it can be used for anything. It's not just PGAT. It can be used for any pain. So this is where we start. So you have your vulva or penis as the end organ. Then we move up to the pelvis. And I feel like treating more people, pelvis can be pelvic floor. It can be the peripheral nerves into the pelvis, like the pudendal nerve. But there's also your abdominal wall and your viscera and everything in that abdominal pelvic cavity that could cause tension on the clitoris. So your clitoris suspensory ligament blends into the abdomen. So let's say a C-section, a abdominal pelvic surgery, even abdominoplasty, anything that's like pulling up, breast cancer, reconstruction after breast cancer with the abdominal flap, anything that's kind of within that region that can add some tension. Also endometriosis. I've had 3 people recently who we've gotten everything down to like a 2 out of 10, and it just always, there was something else missing, and that they're much, much better after they had their excision surgery. So really that now we're looking more pelvis. Then region 3 is cauda equina. Okay. So lumbosacral spine. So, but this isn't the cauda equina syndrome that we learned about in school. That's like medical emergency. I'm completely incontinent. I can't feel my legs. I have saddle anesthesia. Those are considered medical emergencies. This is like a mild cauda equina, and you don't really quite know where it's going. And so if we think of an annular tear, there's a tear in the annulus that surrounds the disc. That disc material inside is toxic. It's like, that's supposed to stay in the disc. It's not supposed to be bathing in your nerves. And that's what happens. It leaks out of that tear and it pours onto the cauda equina. So that's why at L4, you could have sacral, you could have S2 to S4 symptoms, you could have pelvic symptoms. And most spinal doctors are going to be like, that's not possible. That's not possible, because you need to have a problem between S2 and S4 when that's not true. You can have it higher up because that fluid's leaking onto. So it's like, this is the spinal canal. You just have these loose nerves. They're called your cauda equina. Okay. So they end higher up in the back, and they're just, it's like a horse's tail, right? So it's just flying through. So if your disc is here, like the worst, let's say your disc is here and leaking out, it can just be bathing on nerves into the canal. So that's that mechanism. Region 4 is spinal cord. So, I mean, potentially if you have MS, if you have, I've heard of people in the PGAD support group who have MS. They haven't done enough research in that area. There haven't been enough cases that have come forward with that. Because you also got to think, many women take many, many years to be diagnosed because they also don't disclose this. They have partners that don't know about this. They don't tell their doctors because they're afraid. And I understand. Region 5 is brain. So end organ, pelvis and perineum is what it's called in the paper, cauda equina, spinal cord, and brain.
Thank you. I think that really helps to sort of walk through. Years ago, I had a lady who all of her pelvic dysfunction in this neighborhood happened literally because she had a tumor mass they removed up higher in the thoracic spine.
Interesting.
And then it ended up that she had tarsal cysts low. And everyone said, it has nothing to do with your pelvic pain. And because hers was more regional, you know, it wasn't the end organ. It was sort of the number 2 region. Mm-hmm. You know, they really, really dismissed her. And here she was, a high level functioning medical professional, and suddenly was unable to work because of this, you know, progression. Mm-hmm. So this is such important work. To understand the regions and why we're looking at the regions the way we are and all the implications that can happen because of it, because it can be so missed and they are, you know, kind of pushed outside the medical. I mean, she was basically told, hey, like, you need to go on medication because, you know, you're crazy. And it's difficult, right? Because when you look at regional work, do you know what I mean? In this way, you really do say, okay, you know, well, it's not here, but oh, here, let's go to the next things and look and
front. And sometimes they overlap, right? So you could have two regions that are contributing. And also, you know, just because you, let's say they fix your disc, right? We know as PTs, you have to work on that motor retraining. Doesn't mean, you know, you don't need to still do some nerve work and some pelvic floor treatment and really treat the whole system too. So it may not be a quick fix, but it definitely, I mean, I did a lot of rehab. I mean, I believe in rehab, but I had become so avoidant of certain activities or movements. Like, I never turned my hip in, pretty much ever. So what does that do over time with compensation? Every time I internally rotate my hip, it shot into my vagina, it shot into my clitoris. So I mean, what doctor is going to explain that? They're going to say that makes no sense. So I became pretty weak in my left leg. I had radiculopathy too. I actually had weakness in my leg, but learning how to move again in more efficient ways, because you wouldn't see me and say, oh, that person's disabled, right? You can hide it well just walking around. And I was active. I kept walking. That's what kept my sanity. I hiked, I walked. That was pretty much the only time my pain and symptoms were at their lowest, is if I were walking. So,
April, so let's just segue a little bit just to the whole idea of, you know, we always say, oh, you know, 1 in 3 women have some sort of pelvic health disorder in the U.S., right?
Right.
But the data seems actually higher than that, just in sexual health issues overall. I mean, it looks like, especially you kind of brought up, you know, like, you know, as a woman ages, even, you know, there's so many changes. And now we know so much more about perimenopause and menopause and all of these things. You brought up lichen sclerosis. I think that's an important thing to look at. Mm-hmm. We know that lichen sclerosis is an autoimmune disease and that it's actually on the rise, you know, in our country in women over 50. Mm-hmm. And so the data looks like it's actually higher for women who have actually have sexual health issues, really.
Yeah.
More up in like the 43 to 48%. And that's a huge amount of women who really are not having the enjoyment of what sexual health should bring to their life.
Right.
So we've been talking a lot about, you know, how do we help women sort of have yearly pelvic health checks, like with a pelvic PT, right? Just like you would have a pelvic health check with your primary care physician for all of your other things, right? But now we should have a yearly pelvic health check, you know, just to make sure, hey, everything in the pelvis is good. We're not missing anything, et cetera, especially women. Yeah. And then the other idea is that teaching, you know, women in general and men, of course, too, but just starting in the women direction first, I think is to help people of all genders learn, hey, this is what your pelvic floor is. You should look at it just like you do a breast self-exam. We should 100%. Be doing an exam once a month of the pelvic floor. And what I mean by that is just exactly part of what you said. Hey, looking at the end organ and saying, hey, I had some pain down there. Do you know what I mean? On the right side, or maybe I had a UTI 3 weeks ago and I took all the medication, but I still have this lingering thing at all the end organs in the floor. Or maybe at the end of the day, after I trained and worked out really hard, suddenly I felt like I was heavier in the floor. Maybe I can't see a pelvic organ prolapse, but I feel changes.
Right.
Talk to me about your thoughts. You know, we do such specialized work, I think, in the pelvic health arena. And I think we need to really proclaim it to everybody that these are such important organs that do such important things to keep us healthy long term that we need a better way to present, like, hey, once a year checks and teaching people self-checks, right? So they know what it is am I looking for. Tell me what you feel about those things.
I love that you're bringing this up. So many thoughts in my head. I mean, I think it should start
as young as we educate kids in school about bowel and bladder. I mean, I know you understand this, like you have kids too, but it's like, you know, once we're done changing diapers, we have no idea what's happening.
And so there's a lot of constipated kids. There's a lot of young girls pushing their pee out. I hear them in the stall if I'm next to kids. And it's just like, it's like that. You're not supposed to do that because we don't talk about this area of our body. Which I don't want to say this area. We don't talk about our genitals. It's like taboo. It's associated with shame. Like these are normal functions of our bodies. And sex is one of those functions. I'm not saying, I'm not going to get into the whole, like, when do you talk to your kids about sex? That's a thing. But even as far as like just, urogenital, bowel health, all of that, that's a great intro. Not that we want people to like persever over these things, but let's just get comfortable talking about poop. Let's get comfortable talking about pee. Everyone does it. And so I think starting young, a lot of the things that we see when people are older, it's because they've been doing the same pattern since they're children. And it can always change. They just need to get seen. And our bodies change through our lifespan. And there's young girls I see who, have been on birth control pills. And I'm not saying birth control pills are bad. I could never say that. But there are for some people, there's doing more research on that. It sensitizes that vestibule. And then when they do first have intercourse or they have any sort of penetration or put in a tampon, it is excruciating. Okay. We also talked a lot of some research in Ishwish that came up about they found women who have a neuroproliferative type of vestibular dyspnea. So there's an excess growth of nerve endings, and it's not always, it can be genetic, right? They're just born with that and they don't know until they first put anything inside them, which, could be a tampon or a speculum or, something more sexual related, but they can also have it acquired. And what they're seeing is women who use miconazole, right? Over-the-counter yeast treatment, the active and inactive ingredients in some of these creams that we're being told are even just like those hygiene creams, which is complete baloney, right? You are putting things on your vulva that can irritate you so badly that it's causing excess nerve growth. And now you have this problem that has to be surgically excised. These are not harmful, harmless things. And this was some of the research they presented, or even things like Desitin, right? We all put that on our babies, right? Or we A&D ointment. There are certain chemicals in them that later on, because they asked them, they said, what has been on her vulva? What has been on? And some of these inactive ingredients or zinc oxide based things are not okay for the vulva. And it can be happening when you're a baby and you don't know till later. So I think we do need to be more careful of what we put on our bodies. That's one thing. And then further, down the line, so hormonal mediated vestibular dyspnea that can start happening, younger with OCPs, but with medication, but also as we lose estrogen and we also lose testosterone. So the vestibule has a higher concentration of androgen receptors on it, which for testosterone, than they do actually estrogen. So for many people, topical estrogen is not enough on the vestibule, right? You need a compounded base with tea in that as well. And so not a lot of providers will give you that, right? So, and also just we're talking about our anatomy changes when we lose estrogen, right? Like our clitoris gets smaller, our labias get smaller. You don't have that protection, right? These are all androgen and some more testosterone specific tissues up in your G spot or G zone area can be very painful. Many women have, especially as they're getting older, they're getting more frequent UTIs, and UTIs are dangerous. Like people are hospitalized because of UTIs. If you're having frequent UTIs, there may be a hormonal component happening at your vestibule inside the vagina. And I mean, this is something that we need to know about this so we can ask for this. And I feel like women are, there's so much more information out there now online and social media, which, you know, you need to be following the right sources, right? They're getting the right information and not the inaccurate information. But I think we're demanding more. And I think everyone goes through this. Everyone is going to go through menopause, and every woman, vulva owner, is going to go through menopause. So, I mean, it may be easier for some than others, but a lot of people struggle, and we're not, we want to know why, we want to know what we can do. And I think that time of like, oh, just put up with it. You're a woman. This is what happens. Like, we're not having it. So a yearly pelvic floor check to see how our bodies are changing and shifting would be amazing.
So April, I'm just going to overview this just really quick, because at the end of the show, I just want people to kind of know, like, you know, if they want a list of maybe allergens or irritants in the floor, they're welcome to reach out to you or to me about that, because I want people to understand, like, some people are allergic to certain things, and it actually makes the end organ, so that region one of the floor, highly, I mean, it's literally an allergic reaction to whatever they're putting there. And then there's a whole list of irritants that maybe over time cause more agitation to the floor, and just understanding that they may be using something that seems generic, like something perfumey based down there that actually is causing part of the problem. And and you brought up a really good, you know, thought process of like, hey, if you have excessive growth of nerve tissue, right, now you get actual blood flow to this area, because you've created all this agitation, and suddenly it becomes its own little, you know, its own little growth pocket. And that is why that is such a dangerous thing, like over time, right? Because you literally change the way that floor functions and works. And I think that's why, like, having the understanding of, you know, maybe people put all these things out here, like, oh, this is a great thing to use on your floor, but really, is it?
Right.
And are there irritants, even in the inactive ingredients, that maybe are causing a lot of these problems?
Right.
So at the end of the show, we'll just talk about, like, hey, how you can reach both April and I, because I think it's really important for people to understand that. And then I just want to segue, because you said something that was interesting to me about, you know, their whole reason for labia. You know, it is for protection, correct? You know, the labia are a protection. And so I have a lot of younger women who look at labioplasties and changing the labia and doing all these things. And I just want you to, I know this is something really controversial, but I just want you to shout out a little bit about why the labia are there and why they are important.
I hate the idea of labioplasties, but I don't want to, like, just because I think our bodies are beautiful and unique, and I don't need to look like everyone else. And they do offer protection. They offer, you know, from bacteria getting irritating our tissues, and they offer sensation. Like, they attach to your clitoris, and they can be, they're supposed to, you know, your whole vulva swells and gorges with blood during sexual activity. And that's going to allow for any sort of penetration to be more comfortable, more pleasurable. It can help with orgasms. It's just labia, they're beautiful, and they're, and I mean, I understand how some people sometimes, if their labia is maybe an extreme length to them, that might be uncomfortable. I know I hear surgeons say, well, it's really uncomfortable for them. And so I'm not, you know, judging. I think you should do whatever you want with your body, but our labia shrink as we age. So it also seems strange how, why do we want to look like little girls? Like, I don't know if that's okay to say, but it's like our vulva, our labia grow when we're in our reproductive, like through puberty, and then they're full and luscious and, you know, during our reproductive years. And why do we want them to be smaller? And it's just a very strange thing to me. But I understand, like, there's just, people have different tastes and aesthetics, and maybe it is causing
like rubbing and irritation. And I mean, if that's a functional issue, I understand. But I mean, I would love if my labia were actually a little longer. Because they've changed. They shrink in size in perimenopause. And your tissues shrink up. We don't like to say atrophy anymore. It's called genitourinary syndrome of menopause. But it almost should be perimenopause. Like, this starts early on. Even if you see someone who's birth control pills or what, you know, they're sometimes when you see their vulva, it looks like a vulva that's closer to someone in their 50s or 60s versus 25, because they're not receiving the hormones to the tissues. And so not only does that, you know, it can reduce your libido, just like some psychiatric meds do too. It's just your clitoris is literally changing its size. It's not getting the hormones that it needs. So does that answer?
Yeah, no. Thank you. Again, I think I just want to reiterate, like, hey, yeah. Just like you said, you know, you're not trying to say to somebody, oh, that's bad if you want to do that. You're trying to say, like, hey, it has a function to it. Right. That is why it's there. Right. It actually grows and changes as you and I have need patterns, right?
Right.
And then as we change, as we, you know, move towards perimenopause and menopause, we're definitely going to have changes in that whole region. Mm-hmm. And so I just want people to understand, like, it has a real function. It has a real thing that, and it's there for a reason. Mm-hmm. And honestly, a huge component of it is for pleasure and for, you know what I mean? All of those components. And you certainly wouldn't want to remove that unless there's some real issue that's creating a problem.
I agree.
And so I just want to challenge people to think first before thinking, oh, these are just too big, or this is too this, or this is too that. Like, there's tissue there, and it really provides us with some amazing things, that particular tissue, because it engorges so much and it fills so much. So I appreciate your words about it. Let's just talk just for a second, too, about, you know, some of the topical things that people maybe use, you know, like DHEA and HA together, or maybe, you know, there was a great study that came out with, I mean, absolutely amazing pictures of use of it in the, you know, in the vestibule area of DHEA, HA. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, okay, then you move into the whole estrogen and testosterone and like you're talking about topical and uptake. What is your feelings about all that? You know, I know people sometimes have a lot of confusion in my own practice. Mm-hmm. Like we utilize that so much as people have moved through their reproductive years, but even sometimes in their reproductive years, like right after baby, maybe they need a little HA, DHEA to plump that tissue up.
Right.
I had a physician out of UCLA who literally shared with me, it was years ago. She said, oh, I would love it if, you know, every woman after their first year after their baby had some estrace or some sort of DHEA on board topically just for that year, just to help that tissue plump back up, get its resiliency, its rugae back, you know, all of its texture
and
back.
Plus you're healing during that time. If you have a vaginal birth, you're also healing on top of it. So at Ishwish, they termed it genitourinary symptoms of lactation, not of menopause. That's what they're trying to call it, because our estrogen levels do drop when we're lactating after birth. And
I love that. That's great. Yeah. That helps so much.
Well,
right.
Because we don't have to call it menopause. We don't have to, you know, but it's essentially what happened. It's a hormone change. So whether it's due to medications, whether it's due to, there are different causes for it. But yeah, I think people, if they're experiencing pain, I mean, we're told that you're okay to have sex at 6 weeks, but then you also have vestibulodynia on top of it. Like So doing a topical cream to the vestibule and those healing tissues, it can help a lot for sure.
You know, I appreciate you sharing that. And I what was the other term that they
used? Genitourinary symptoms of lactation, and then genitourinary symptoms of menopause is what GSM is what we now call, like we used to call it vaginal atrophy, which is just such an awful,
I know,
vaginal vulvar vaginal, like it, yeah. And it, you know, it really doesn't take into account the genital urinary component, right? So we're calling it atrophy. You're not really looking at the systems involved. The urinary system becomes very affected. And it's the UTIs, it's the sensitization, it's all those tissues that rely on hormones that become affected.
April, thank you for saying that, because I think when people don't really, you know, they're thinking it's sort of just of a sexual health thing. And we're like saying, no. This directly affects all urinary function and urinary tissue and and supporting all of that with maybe topical things of that nature as you and I go through all these crazy hormonal, you know, shifts, you know, throughout whether it's reproductive years. Well, even early on with young women, you know, but reproductive years. And then as we walk through it, there may be different time frames that different things are needed, right? Because of it. And it directly affects the urinary tract and, you know, bladder health and all of that, when really we could be maybe having way less of that pain pattern.
100%.
UTIs, right?
It's the prevention. And I think we as pelvic therapists, we really play a role in the screening. And, you know, we sometimes have an hour or more with our patients, and we can do a more thorough exam. It's not necessarily the fault of the physician who can see you for 10 minutes and they have to go over. They have so many other tests that they need to do for your health. Right. And so we have the opportunity to say, yeah, you know, your tissues look like they're changing. I, you know, think you should go back to your gynecologist or go see this urologist. Go, you know, some people do have more specialization in sexual medicine. There are NAMS providers, right? So they have a NAMS provider website, North American Menopause Society. There are different providers that you need someone who's like current, really current and up to date. And I feel like Ishwish providers should be that as well. But so, yeah.
April, let's just talk just from a business perspective just for a second, because I love what you mentioned before just about, you know, telehealth. And I think sometimes people have the confusion when it looks, you know, like pelvic health. Oh, well, how are you going to telehealth? But I want people to have the vision that many times what you and I are doing with our telehealth is actually screening and helping people work through some of these regional things, right, that we're talking about, so that then we can either then see them in person, get them to somebody who can see them in person, find them a physician. So we're using telehealth as a screening tool as well. Talk to me about your feelings about telehealth and the pelvic health.
Right. I think it definitely has its place. Like you said, screening, education, you know, certainly a physical exam is really important. And it, you know, depends on your state laws and all that. I do out-of-state consults. I'm not giving them physical therapy services. I'm more, take me through your history. Okay. Have you tried this? Have you tried that? What are, you know, figuring out like who is in your area that could help you? What PT would be good for you to go get a screening? What physician, you know, should you see? But we are so used to really taking all this information and kind of cutting what has worked, what hasn't worked, you know, where they're at, what their goals are, to kind of paint a picture without even touching them of what possibly could be going on. And that's really helpful information to say, okay, I left here. Now I have a plan. I'm going to go talk to this person. I'm going to go to this person for an exam. You know, it might be three of these things driving. It could be this driving. We need to figure it out. I think when you understand the fear, the anxiety, I mean, it's so nice to have a plan of how to help yourself, because all you know is you have pain and you want it to stop, or you can't do this thing anymore, or something is wrong. Is there an infection? I mean, that's the other thing. You could have like a vulvovaginal, like a recurrent, difficult to treat infection that maybe that physician is only testing for certain things, or there's other sorts of swabs, depending on what doctor you go to, that might be able to pick something up, or even just a nutritionist, right? Even like depending on what's happening, you can really help someone build a team no matter where they're at in the country, I feel. And Yeah, there's, I mean, I think when we first, you know, started doing telehealth, it was like, how am I going to do that? Like, we're so hands-on, right? We like to put our hands on people, and just getting information and going through a history can give us so many, they can just give us so much direction, and we can help them get to those people that can help them. So it's really this collaborative effort, and they don't have to be alone with it and just searching.
And that's why, you know, I just want to bring up that April, you can reach April at wholebodyla.com. It's super important to me for us to, you know, continue to like press forward with pelvic health. There are so many people that have so much need. And I just feel like, you know, there aren't enough providers. There aren't enough, you know, people sort of in this space, sort of helping, you know, communities of people sort of navigate. Mm-hmm. And so I just want people to understand that someone like April with her background is a perfect person to help you navigate as you move through these things. This is powerful work.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, even if you're not in her local region, these things are the way this works. And it's the only way we're going to do it. You know, right now, the data is showing 1 in 3 medical providers are leaving our profession, leaving our field. Mm. Not only our field, but like all the other medical fields. And so I think the information, the education, all of that is super important. You know, I see telehealth people all over the place who literally, you know, it's us helping them find the right people wherever they live, right?
But right.
Why are we doing it? Because we're so passionate. And I know you are about like helping people understand their body and then taking ownership of it. And then it's like their anxiety levels go down and their ability to be like, oh, I actually get to have a higher quality of life.
Right.
I actually do get to do all these fun things I want to do. And you and I are, yes, absolutely 100%. And I think, you know, that's the amazing part of this is trying to help people. And you, with just your background and understanding, I think in the sexual health component of this is such a powerful work, because people are scared sometimes to even talk to anybody about it. You know, they may come in for one thing. Oh, you know, I have this bowel constipation.
Right.
And suddenly what's on the table for you and I is, wow, like their whole, you know, sexual health component came out. But we want that. And we want people to know that is just as important to your overall well-being as your bowel and your bladder. Like all 100%. Of these things, you know, go together. And I'm so thankful that you were with us today. And I just think
it's so happy to be here. I think everyone should ask about sexual health. Every provider needs to get more comfortable asking about sexual health. Even if you're like, okay, well, this is good to know. You're having difficulty having an orgasm. You're having pain down there. You know, I may not be the best person to help you, but let me find someone who can. Like, you don't have to know everything. You don't have to be an expert in everything. There's doctors have so many, you know, areas of study. But just even open up that door, that conversation, we could be helping so many people. They don't have to suffer. And we believe you. Like, this is not as uncommon as maybe the statistics show. I just think we don't talk about it. And it is still common. If you talk to any of your friends about this, I'd say the majority have had something, right? Oh, I didn't know that. And sometimes these pelvic floor dysfunctions can be happening for a long time until they become symptomatic, right? And often that it's not just the pelvic floor. There could be something else, but we have ways to tease that out. And we're really good detectives as PTs. And I think that that's a quality that can really help you get to your people so you can have some resolution. You shouldn't have to suffer. It shouldn't have to be like this. You should be able to enjoy your sex life however you want. We should be able to go through perimenopause without pain. You should be able to wear underwear. You should be able to sit without pain. It's not okay. It's not. So
April, just tell us in this next year, what is maybe some of your goals that you would like to accomplish in this space and in your professional work?
Yeah. So I just got home last night. So it was 5 days of all of this, and it was really exciting. And I met some new people, and, you know, I have some different ideas about how I might want to collaborate. I really want to go in a more education direction. I love treating. That's my first love always. But, you know, I can't treat all the people and I have to kind of have boundaries and limit myself just because I have other physical health issues and a family. And so I really want to get the word out more about sexual health and persistent genital arousal disorder, GPD. I have created a course for physical therapists and I'm hoping to do some webinars and just really let people know, do some Q&As, because I do think we have such an important role in the treatment of PGAD as well as like screening for spine, like even just knowing the five regions, right? That this could be coming from here and coming from there. Let's get you to the right people. Like you said, sometimes we're like a referral source. Right. We have no problem saying, I don't know how to treat that. Why don't you go? Right. Like we but we will give you everything we can. We're going to give you everything we can. And there may be things that also you learn from us, like how do we modify your activity so you can get through the day with less flares, or that you can, I mean, just our background in function and understanding how the body works with movement and, you know, their adaptive devices and cushions. Like there's so many things that we can offer, even if we're not going to be the one that like fixes your thing. There are ways we can help you manage with your thing so you have a more comfortable, functional life. So,
April,
I love our profession in this realm. I really do.
Me too. Yeah. So I have a question. I know you're the founder and the owner of your business. I want to know, like, how do you handle adversity that maybe comes your way? And like, what are just some tips you have for those of us who are self-employed, who have, you know, embarked on this journey of like actually, you know, living and breathing and eating it every day, right? How do you handle this safe?
I think always just like being true to your authentic self. Right. So you're going to see people doing things. You might be like, oh, I should do that or I should do this. What can you really handle on your plate? Like what are your boundaries going to be? It could be boundaries with patients. It could be boundaries with, you know, financial. I think that social media has, again, like its pluses with the information and the resources. It can also be very draining. It can also make you feel kind of bad about yourself. Like you're not doing that. I know I felt like that before. Like I'm not the person that really ever compared myself. And I'm like, oh God, like, you know, I need to turn this off because I'm starting to feel like I'm not doing enough in my business and I can only do what I can do. And I went out on my own because I really wanted to offer the treatment I can do that, you know, isn't necessarily covered by insurance or, and I hate that because I want to be accessible to everyone. But there are people in insurance-based spaces in my community who I say, you know, go see them. They're great. Or I know that at that company, you can be seen for an hour. Like, I'm fine. Like, I'm not competitive with other people because really my self and what I care about are the people. And so I'm pretty much like, people are going to come your way if you give good care. A lot of word of mouth. I know some states don't have direct access, whatever it may be. I mean, I know physicians want outcomes, right? So it's like, if you can do your good work and stay true to yourself, you will have more business. It depends what your goals are right now. Depends on the week. I'm like, okay, I can't see any more patients this week. I'm going to have to put the boundary down and start referring out more or get a wait list or just like, we all can collaborate. There's a space for all of us. We don't need this competition. We really should just be helping each other out. Our main goal is to take care of people and help them, like you said, empower themselves, help them get better, help them return or have a more functional, happy quality of life. Like, let's just be kind.
Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's enough to go around. Like, yeah.
Absolutely. There is. And we have so much work to do. And I love your thoughts that you are so collaborative because I really do believe that's where all this is going to go. And, you know, I think that, you know, in-person care is going to be important as well. But I believe that we're in order to reach, do you know what I mean? And give access to people so that they get the whole progression of the steps. you know, telehealth is going to be a huge component of it, of it long term, because people need to have direction. You know, they need to have somebody walking them through so they don't see 8 or 10 physicians and get to so discouraged. Do you know what I mean? And like you said before, maybe be, you know, gaslit or like told, oh, that's all in your head. Whereas, you know, we can, because we in our work do this every day, that we can actually affect change in our country for pelvic health care.
100% And there are, like, there's recently, it made me think of Dr. Sarah Signa. She's in Washington, D.C., and she's in a more hospital-based system, but they have a sexual medicine fellowship now. And even though she's in a hospital-based system, because I asked her, I'm like, how do you do all the things? Because you have 15 minutes or 20 minutes, or it depends. She's like, they know we're going to do this. Then they're going to come back next week. So sometimes it's more frequent visits. Sometimes you see people more frequently. So you can get all the information you need. And if you communicate that, that this is going to take some time and these are the things we need to look at first and screen for and test, blah, blah, blah. Like there's a way where everyone, I feel, can have care for pelvic health and sexual medicine. I really do. Sometimes it involves money. Sometimes it involves travel, but there is a way, and maybe it's going to be more telemedicine and telehealth to at least just say, okay, you know, this is something you need to come see me for, or this is something you can see this person for. Like, we all got to understand each other, and we can't work in these silos anymore. We have to connect, or people aren't going to get better.
And I think that's the beauty of like Ishwish and going to some of these, right, national or international meetings, right? And you and I being part of them as a PT, because now you're mixing with so many different professions, right? So that your collaboration goes deeper. And I think it changes you, right? Because
it then really does.
You're not looking at just pelvic PT, you know, you're going to only pelvic PT. So I want to encourage pelvic PTs that are out there in the world, please, just like April's done, you know, being part of these different organizations where there is such collaborative work going on with, you know, different, you know, whether it's urogynes or just regular MDs versus a physiatrist versus a, you know, whatever it is, we want the integration of it, because that's the way our pelvic floor physical therapy gets known.
Right.
And then we have a seat at the table and we can stand up and do the work the way we need to so that we can help this all be better, you know, across our country, really, is what we're after.
And I think they want us there, too. Like, they do respect our profession where, you know, I do think there's a mystery still about what we do. I think it's really hard to articulate sometimes because there's more of an art to it in a way at times. But they want us there. They are encouraging physical therapist, pelvic therapist to come, because I mean, I know I've learned so much just even how they think, what their process is, you know, what I, again, should be screening for too, the history. It adds another layer to our history taking, and they want to work with us. Like, we help their patients. They want to work with us. And I don't think it's, you know, it depends who you talk to, but we're less of the like tech doing the pelvic floor work than maybe they used to think of us as, like, oh, they just, I mean, they may not know what we do internally and like how the whole system works together, because we're really musculoskeletal experts in the whole system, but they know that we're a part of the solution. And I think, I mean, you're still going to hear, like, why haven't I been into PT? Why didn't my OBGYN send me to PT? Like, we're still going to hear that. But there is this wave of younger, even, like, youthful energy, more informed physicians who refer to us and who want us and want to connect with us. And it is a great opportunity to meet them and network with them. So...
No, I appreciate that, April, so much. And I just want to encourage everybody to start thinking about that and thinking about going, you know, and being part of maybe whatever their passion is. And everybody in this work of pelvic health, it's such a big work, you know, have different passions for women's and men's health, you know, in the pelvic region. And then being able to connect in all those different ways, I think it will change you know, the way we actually deliver care and the way mm-hmm. we are part of all that integration, because we bring such a depth of knowledge, I think, in the whole musculoskeletal component.
No one else has that but us.
Yeah.
Like, that's our bread and butter. Like, we understand how this system works. We can help you get to where you want to be, right? Maybe you need a medication or a procedure, but we're going to get you to where you want to be functionally. And they, I think to have one and not the other isn't okay. Like, so.
Yeah. April, last thing. Will mm-hmm. you just tell us maybe like one story of like what keeps you so passionate every day and why you wake up to do this? Just so people can understand where all that comes out from.
One is hard. I think it's a shared story amongst kind of everyone that I see. They've been suffering, some for different lengths of time, and a lot of young women too, a lot of young women, or, you know, older women that have kept this under wraps, that have just really kept it their secret. Gosh, okay, so someone just popped up now. She is somewhere in the Northwest, and we did a consult, and she saw a YouTube video of me discussing my urinary symptoms. At some point, I discussed how I had this surgery, blah, blah, blah. And I guess she had all the same symptoms as me. So she reached out at me and she's like, oh my gosh, like, I've never heard of this, because not only do we not talk about it, but she told me her husband didn't even know. She'd been married to him for 30 years. And, you know, she doesn't really have sex much because of the pain, but, you know, they just kind of, the people grinning, we as women, we know how to smile. We know how to mask. We know how to get through it. We know how to put everyone else in front of ourselves. And we have so much guilt sometimes when we have to take care of ourselves or when something's wrong with us. And I mean, this woman was in the military. She, you know, had many jobs. She's a very intelligent, very, was giving so much back to society. And then she was disabled. And the impact of that, just mentally, emotionally, socially, how this impacts all of our function. And I think we have to talk about this stuff more. We have to, I'm like going to tear up. And I mean, all I did was kind of point her in the direction and offer her almost like a friend of someone who's been through this, like someone who can relate to her. And I feel like after, I mean, this was like 30 years of this, and she had like constant UTI. She's on every antibiotic. She's on so many psych meds. And she's like, I don't have these conditions. I'm you know, dealing with the pain. People get addicted to opiate. I mean, there's just so many things that go wrong just because we either don't listen, don't understand, don't connect with people that can help us. I mean, this interconnectivity really needs to happen, like you said. And I think this is the future. And I mean, I didn't physically treat her, but I got her some help and I got her in the right direction. And just even having a conversation about this, it can make a big difference. Like, there are support groups. And again, sometimes support groups trigger people and they don't like them. They're not for everybody. But if you do want to find someone that maybe you relate with, you could even like reach out to someone in the support group that maybe you connect with and make a friend, you know, make someone who you're having a bad day, you want to talk to about it. You just want to, there are other people like you out there and you're not alone. And it doesn't mean there isn't hope. Just because someone else didn't get better or didn't find their solution doesn't mean that you won't. We're not. And I do think when you look up some of these conditions and it says there's no cure, it's like, oh God, like you can live with things and being very, very mildly symptomatic or not, and live a full life and be really, really happy. Or there are things that can potentially fix you. But you know how, you know, with pain, there's a lot. When you have symptoms for many, many years, there's other aspects to that as well that affect your nervous system. But there is hope. And absolutely. I think, yeah.
April, thank you so much for being on the show today. I love it. I could talk to you all day.
Me too.
Next year, Ishwish will be there.
Yes,
okay,
we
together.
Will connect, for sure.
That would be great.
I can't wait.
Again, I just want everybody to know where to find April, wholebodyla.com. If you need a list of irritants or allergens mm-hmm. in the pelvic floor, region one end mm-hmm. organs, you can absolutely reach out to April, or you can reach out to me as well at sherry@lakecitypt.com or just at our website, lakecityphysicaltherapy.com. So I just want you to know how important all of your work is, April. And
thank
I
you.
Just love it that you're giving a voice and you're empowering people with their sexual health. It means so much. And let's just do this thing and keep
okay.
moving forward with all of it.
Let's do this. I'm excited. I was so wonderful to meet you back then. And I'm glad we're still connecting and That's we just great. Clicked, you know, it was. It's nice to see you again.
It is. It's a great thing. Oh, great. All right.
Okay.
Thanks, April.